reading, raise your hand and I'll stop and try to explain to you. But I've prepared the paper and I'll read it. I maybe should give a little bit of introduction to this. I have been studying single men in the church for several years. In 1983, I published an article in Dialogue, which talked about mostly the well-known, well-connected single man who made, I felt, a large contribution to the church. This is an attempt to look at those who were more common and were living in rural areas. And so as we go through this, I'd like to point out some of the things that I wanted to find out from this study. The Mormon emphasis on marriage began early and was pronounced as scripture in 1842 when Joseph Smith announced his revelation, "In the celestial glory there are three heavens or degrees, and in order to obtain the highest, a man must enter into this order of the priesthood," interpreted to mean the new and everlasting covenant of marriage. "If he does not, he cannot obtain it." Church leaders not only taught that marriage was necessary for salvation, but it was important in a social sense. In their drive to conform the earthly kingdom they were building to their understanding of the heavenly kingdom, they left no room for single people. And I'm emphasizing and quoting things about single men, so there is research on single women too. An unsigned 1849 article in the Frontier Guardian, a newspaper published by church leaders in Canesville, Iowa, declared that a man who resolves to live without woman and the woman who resolves to live without man are enemies to the community. And I think this is really an important emphasis. Enemies to the community in which they dwell, injurious to themselves, destructive to the world, apostates from nature, and rebels against heaven and earth. So they're pretty strong on this. Mormon literature throughout the 19th century and up to our own time has taught that marriage was essential to salvation. This idea has also been linked to the feeling that single men are sin susceptible and that their sins can cause the destruction of society. Apostle Orson Hyde denounced bachelors who gratify their fleshly desires, leaving the consequences altogether with the confiding females. President Brigham Young felt that bachelors would continue to ruin every virtuous woman they can, buying the virtue of women with money and deception. So this is the description that church leaders are describing single men. And what I'm trying to do in my studies is to see if this is true. Joseph F. Smith also linked marriage for salvation and society needs in an article entitled "The Righteousness of Marriage and Its Opposite." He wrote, "We hold that no man who is marriageable is fully living his religion who remains unmarried." Okay, so he's not living his religion. He is doing a wrong to himself by retarding his progress, by narrowing his experience, and to society by the undesirable example that he sets to others, as well as he himself being a dangerous factor in the community. That's probably the quote I should have had in the title, "A Dangerous Factor in the Community." Despite this intense pressure on Mormon men to marry from the beginning, some have chosen to remain single. We cannot know the reasons for this choice in most cases. Certainly, some choose to reject the church and its counsel. Others simply ignored the counsel of the church leaders because of a strong personal preference or feeling that they were still personally acceptable to the Lord despite their singleness. Others, no doubt, felt the advice was for someone else, not themselves. Some found them in the social trap of having procrastinated marriage past the point of finding a partner that they would think suitable. Interestingly, some of these single men have become involved with church programs and have become important contributions to church history and culture. George John Taylor, the eldest son and the eldest child of President John Taylor, was a pioneer newspaper editor and businessman in Utah. He was a member of the Salt Lake High Council for many years. This is when the High Council had a great deal of authority because Salt Lake State covered much of the church at that time. And he never married. Another single man, John R. Park, was president of the University of Deseret, later the University of Utah, for 23 years. So when you go to the Park building, we're honoring John Park. The writer of many Mormon hymns, in fact, I normally say most of them, the largest percentage of Mormon hymns in our present hymn book are written by Evan Stevens, who is the director of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. But most single men did not occupy these socially prominent positions. This paper seeks to discover the men who lived quiet lives in rural Mormon communities where they heard the teachings of these general authorities and statements and yet chose to remain single. They probably heard similar things from local leaders and yet lived and worked in a hostile environment. When I started this study, I wanted to find out how many single men there were in Mormonism. Did the norms of that society affect the number? By using the marital status information in the 1880 and 1900 federal censuses, this paper will determine the percentages of single men over 20 and percentages of single men over 30. Also, compare the percentages of single men in non-Mormon communities in Iowa and another one in Illinois. Also, a mining town in Utah, Ophir, and the Mormon-influenced urban area to see if Mormonism, per se, had any effect on the number of single men. The census for these years also provides information on widowed and divorced men, so I've recorded that information. I chose these years because the church formally gave up the practice of plural marriage during this period. This paper will examine whether there were more single men during the period that plural marriage was practiced. Some have proposed the idea that single men, particularly if they were poor or socially awkward, had a hard time finding wives because socially influential, wealthy polygamists were competing for the same young women. In fact, my grandmother, who was 13 when the manifesto was issued, said to me that this was her feeling, that men had a hard time, some of the young men had a hard time finding wives because of this. Rural communities have been selected because of the feeling that the church influence is stronger in rural towns, so the number would be manageable also. The first community, Lehi, Utah, is 30 miles from Salt Lake and is settled in 1850, only 3 years after the first Mormon entry into Salt Lake Valley. During the 1880-1900 period, Lehi had become an important railroad station. Its economy was becoming diversified from its agricultural basis. Of the four communities selected for study, this one contained more non-Mormon influence. The second, Glenwood, Utah, is 160 miles south of Salt Lake in the Sevier Valley. It was settled in 1864 as one of the first settlements in Sevier County, but was hampered in its development by Indian problems till 1870, just 10 years before the census. It was a stable agricultural period being studied. The third town, Huntington, Utah, was in Emery County in eastern Utah, about 140 miles from Salt Lake. It was first settled in 1879, just a year before the census. It was very small. However, by 1900, it had grown into a full-fledged agricultural community. The fourth village is Paris, Idaho, in Bear Lake County. It is settled under the direction of Charles C. Rich, who was an apostle in 1864. It was isolated and shows a drastic decline in population during the 20-year period that I'm studying. In 1880, there were 108 families. In 1900, there were only 48 families.
Excuse me, I find the paper fascinating. Isn't there some way that we can put you in a different place in this room and cut down the noise?
Have you?
It really is.
I guess they'll work on it. I don't know if it would help for me to move. I'd be glad to do anything. What do you think? I'll try to. I hope I'm talking loud enough, am I? Okay. Okay, these four towns represent several stages of development. An old settlement, a new settlement, a growing area, a stable one, and a declining one. These towns will be compared with the English township in Jersey County, Illinois, an old settled agricultural area, and with Marcus, a new settled community in western Iowa. So I'm comparing them with an old settled town, non-Mormon town in Illinois, and one in a new settled town in Iowa. Also with Ophir, as I said, and the 16th Ward here in Salt Lake. The 16th Ward is an urban area by the railroad with numerous multiple family dwellings and an almost a complete absence of agricultural occupations. Each male over 20 years was counted and classified according to marital status, married, single, widowed, and divorced. For both census years, several men that were marked single were later found to be actually widowed, divorced, or even married and living away from home. And these are in the four rural communities I was able to check, make sure the census taker had marked them right. And so those have been changed. The first, the four Mormon towns, the rural towns, there were 538 men over 20 in 1880 and 865 in 1900. 18%...
Turned the wrong one down.
18% of them were single in 1880 and 19% in 1900. So 18% of the men over 20, 18 and 19% of the men over 20 were single in the Mormon towns. This is logical because most of the studies I have seen, 19th century men got married in their early 20s, so they would be over 20 before they got married. This shows, though, that plural marriage did not affect singleness at all. The rate of single men over 30 was 3% in both years. So it was 18 and 19% over 20 in both, 18% in the earlier year and 19% in the later year over 20. I'm assuming from this that plural marriage had no effect then on the four communities show almost identical percentages despite their different stages of development and widespread geographic location. See, one of the things that I was wondering is if in developing communities there were more single men or stable communities would have less, but I found that was not true in this study. There was one difference, and that was the 1900 census for Glenwood that showed a larger percent of single men. But I feel like that it was just a phenomenon of there was a certain project there that these single men had come to help construct some irrigation stuff. And so I think it was not significant in the study. The 16th Ward area, which is interesting. I assume that the urban areas would have more single men. They're almost the same percentage as the rural areas. The 1900 figures for this area in Salt Lake City included 11 Chinese men who by law were not allowed to marry Caucasian women. Since there were few Chinese women in Salt Lake in this period, it is unreasonable to expect them to find wives. If they had been taken out of the study, the urban area would have had a much lower rate of single men. There was a marked difference in the mining town of Ophir. The figures show about half of the men over 20 were not married, and 35% for 1880 and 42% for 1900 of the men over 30 were single. It is possible that single men for surrounding Mormon agriculture communities had come to Ophir to find work. So the mining town had huge percents of single men. In the Midwest, the towns also showed a large difference, and these are just agricultural communities in the Midwest. The more settled area in English Township in Illinois shows almost a third of the men over 20 were single, and 15% in 1880 and 18% in 1900 over 30 were single. So that compares with only 3% in the Utah communities. In the non-Mormon communities, 15 and 18%. In developing, Marcus, Iowa shows a slightly lower percentage of single men than English, but it is still much higher than the Mormon areas. So the Mormon attitudes towards singleness seem to affect the marriage patterns in the Mormon areas. Mormon men seem to also marry earlier. Now, most of the studies that that people do about the rhetoric of the church authorities comparing with the people's actions does not show this much of a correlation. One of the things I wasn't able to do, of course, is to determine how many in the Midwest, the non-Mormon towns, never married. I assume, though, that there was a possibility of a bigger percentage than in the Mormon communities. Then I'll just give you the figures for widowed and divorced. 4% of the adult men in the Mormon areas were widowed. In the non-Mormon towns, there are a little higher percentage of widows. 8% for Marcus, Iowa, and 6% for English, Illinois. I believe this was the result of Mormon teachings which pressured Mormon widowers to marry, and I have some quotes on that. In all the communities, both Mormon and non-Mormon, they reported only 12 divorced men out of 3,086 that I studied. So the number was really too low to derive a percentage. The very low percentage of single men over 30 in rural Mormon towns at the end of the 19th century made me interested in who these men were that were left, these 3%. I looked at those men and found that there were 26 in these four communities. I was able to determine that 11 of them had married before they died. 35-year-old Henry Stocker got married 1 month after the census was taken in Paris, Idaho, to 19-year-old Mary Ann Berry. They, with her mother, are listed on the census in the J.U. Stuckey household, and all three are listed as servants. They were all born in Switzerland along with Stuckey. Of this group, Don Franklin Sherman waited the longest to get married, 14 years after he's listed on the census as single, and at the age of 47, he married a widow, Margaret Black Rowley, but this marriage later ended in divorce. Of the remaining 14 single men, so these are the 14 men that I could not find that they eventually married, half were born outside the United States, three in Denmark. This could account for their singleness. They might not have felt comfortable in this English-speaking society. But this does not completely explain the reason, since Utah at the time had many immigrants from Denmark. Did I say Norway? I meant Denmark. Four of these men lived with their families. Only four of the 14 lived with their families, parents or siblings. Three were living with non-relatives as servants or boarders. The other seven were living alone. The census also shows that five were laborers, indicating they did not own land or have skilled occupations. Two are listed without an occupation. One of them, David Answorth, is listed as crippled. The rest, however, the other seven, are listed with occupations that were significant. Carpenter, farmer, stable owner, who became kind of wealthy in Lehi, railroad employee, and stonemason. This stonemason, John Donaldson, was well known for his stonework and worked on major buildings in Utah. Only one is listed as not being able to read or write, only one out of the 14. I was not able to get any more information than is on the census for four of these. Of the 10 left, I was able to document Mormon church membership for 8. The other two, I believe, were not Mormons. So I believe only 8 of these 10 were Mormon. Of the 10, I can document that 6 died single. In fact, you know, I'm able to document that singleness. But I believe that 3 others also died single. Adam Brown moved from the Glenwood Ward at the age of 75, still single. So I assume that he didn't marry. The other two were buried alone in cemeteries. I was able to find their graves and find that there were no family members around them. So I assume this proves they were single too. The remaining one, Rasmus Rasmussen, had such a common name I lost track of him. There are a lot of Rasmus Rasmussens in Utah that time. I have been unable to discover any personal writings of these men, so we can only know about their lives from other information, the people that had similar experiences. The only diary, I've been doing this research for quite a while, and the only diary of a single Mormon man that I've been able to find is the diary of Henri Dussault. He lived at the same time, this very same time, in a small Mormon community of Kingston, Paiute County, Utah. He was a Swiss convert to the church, so he had some commonality with half these men. And he came to Utah with his mother and niece. Well educated, he wrote English better than he spoke it. And this is probably why he wrote a diary, because he was well educated. Had a large library for Pioneer Utah and subscribed to newspapers from New York, Boston, as well as French language papers published in the United States. Isolated and intensely lonely, he wrote despondently in his diary, "I guess hell itself could not be worse than my past life." His mother had died, and his widowed niece and her family, his only relatives in the church, lived in northern Utah. He was also a little deaf. I found an interesting letter he wrote to John, tells John Taylor in that he was deaf. His diary records that the social problems of a single man in unusual detail. We may assume that other single men, these 14 that I'm talking about, had similar frustrations. Chief among them were their loneliness. One diary entry uses the word alone 9 times in a single sentence. Maybe he was extreme. Maybe the others didn't feel that way. It was hard for him to participate in community activities because he felt unwanted. For example, he cleaned the schoolhouse for the 24th of July program and then did not attend because he felt no one wanted him there. The United Order in which he was a member did not credit his work at the same rate as married men. That made him feel unvalued. The idea was married men have children to support, but to him it meant that they didn't value his work as much. And he also had to hire women to wash his clothes and bake his bread because the time that it took him to do those things would have been deducted from his time in the United Order. DeSalle's bishop called him to be elder's quorum clerk, and he faithfully went to quorum meeting even when no one else attended. He spoke in sacrament meeting and sometimes bore his testimony at fast meeting. Later, the bishop called him to be an acting priest, visiting ward members with his companion. The bishop sometimes visited him in his home and encouraged him in his work. Obviously, he had a place in the community, even though he lacked friends and companionship. He felt responsible for his niece, and when her husband died, he wrote President John Taylor asking if he should leave the United Order so he could help her. In the United Order, it was structured that he really didn't have any extra money. One entry in his diary reads, I had letters from my niece Adele. They were very short letters and don't tell me much. I wished I was better off so I could send Adele something, but I could not this year. If we were nearer, I could help her a great deal more. I think next winter I will move to Ogden, the Lord permitting. And then this is very interesting to me. Unless I find myself a wife in the meantime. This last statement is interesting. He's 56 years old, but still does not accept his single state. Okay, the next part. One of the nicest things about DeSalle's diary is kind of his sexual frustrations come out in his diary. And I've been able to not find that from any other sources. So I want to just read a short passage. DeSalle's diary also contains several passages rare for the 19th century that may acknowledge sexual tensions. I feel a little lonely and lonesome today. I cleaned the schoolhouse preparatory to the people having a dance here tonight. They all went to Anemone today to a picnic at Mr. Winder's. I would like to have gone, but I had to clean the room, which took me till past noon today, after which I went and took a bath in the river, which comforted my old body somewhat. I am now trying to overcome a weakness inherent to me since childhood. I have tried over and over again to overcome it. I have never been able to be 15 days without succumbing to it. I had prayed to the Lord in my earlier days in the woods of St. Basile or something, in my old country, in Switzerland, to have pity on me and overcome me in this terrible weakness. I was not in the church then, yet I prayed to God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob, to have pity on me and help me overcome. But though all these years, and it's 27 years since, I am still very weak, helpless, and all alone, seemingly without a single friend in the whole world who seems to care about me. If that is my destiny, all right, I will not give up trying to break it as long as I can command the will to do it. I feel very miserable at times and still trying to grin and bear it. But I must help myself, and then perhaps God of heaven will have pity on me, help me overcome evil so I can be more useful in the ways of the gospel. And instead of being useless as I am now. I wish these leaders who were talking about these single men who were so evil had known DeSalle and how he worked to try to overcome. I think he's talking about masturbation here and the sexual pressures that he has. And he is very much wanting to be useful to the gospel. This passage may be described in the so-called solitary vice, held abhorrent in the Victorian culture and still, like many non-marital forms of sexual expression, forbidden by the church. If so, it is obvious that DeSalle was suffering more from emotional isolation, low self-esteem, as much or possibly more than sexual frustration. DeSalle had no opportunity to express sexual feelings. He records in his diary, "I joked with the girls again. Ellen McCullough kissed me once but would not let me kiss her again." Of the 8 single men I know were Mormon, none went on missions for the church. 2 had patriarchal blessings. And this is kind of my standard of saying how active they were in the church. And only 1 received his own endowments. Many of them, after they died, their families went and had their endowments done. It is understandable that a low number would get their endowments after reading about the experiences of another single man, John Powell, and his struggle to go to the temple. He was an English coal miner who joined the church and came to America at the age of 43 in 1893. He got a job in Rock Springs, Wyoming, but had a crippling accident which was almost fatal. He was determined to receive his endowments as soon as he, and I'm quoting from him, "feeling strong enough for the journey. I applied to the bishop for a recommend to the Logan Temple. As soon as possible, I made the trip and put up at the Logan House kept by Mr. Blanchard." So he makes the trip from Rock Springs to Logan, but he's in such a bad physical condition because of this accident. He says, after a week's recuperation, so he had to recuperate for a week before he could go to the temple, "I went to the temple. There I was informed that being a single man, I could not have my endowments. You must bring your wife with you, they instructed me. I failed to see it that way. Sensing my obstinacy, the president came and confirmed what had already been told me. I reminded him of the costs of my journey, and here's my recommend endorsed by the stake presidency. I'm going to remain here until I receive my endowments, unless you throw me out." I added, this is from his autobiography, "I cannot soon forget the deep red that mantled the president's cheeks. And in a vehement tone of voice, he said, "You will have your endowments, for you are worthy." They reminded me of the responsibility I was taking upon myself. It was suggested that I discard my walking cane while I was going through the house. I don't know if that was so they would win, so that he had to give up his cane. But anyway, he got to receive his endowments. So you can see why these people wouldn't go get their own endowments because of that. About 1.5% of the men in this study were single all their lives. This would seem like a very small percentage, but as you can see, they were an interesting group. This study has shown that very few men in Mormonism at the turn of the century remained single all their lives. Also, that plural marriage did not seem to affect that number. And make them visible on the fringes of Mormon society. Thanks.
It's a pleasure to comment on Jeff's paper. I consider Jeff a good friend and a very good scholar. I just hope he'll see me in the same light when I finish the comments. I just simply have to preface my remarks with one statement. I received the paper last night, and the only difference it'll make is that about 2 days from now, I'll all of a sudden think I should have said this or I should have said that. It's rather interesting, too. I've only written one personal essay on the single male, and now I've been asked to comment on a paper as an expert, which I'm certainly not. This indicates two things to me. One, there are not very many experts on this subject. And two, the subject is a relatively new one to come under discussion in the church, but I think a very important one. And I think Jeff's paper is very important. And although I'm going to be rather critical, and I may even seem nitpicky in some instances, Jeff, the reason I'm doing this is because I think it's such a fine paper, and I think you've got the basis of something that needs to be published and made known to everyone. So I hope you find these criticisms helpful. I think this is a wonderful beginning thesis, in effect. I just think that as I started reading the paper, I was totally engrossed in it. And I think you found it probably as fascinating as I did. My comments really are kind of nitpicky. The first of all, I would criticize it simply in the fact that the title is never completely addressed. The title of the paper is "A Threat to Society, LDS Single Men Around the Turn of the Century." And when I read that title, it raises a question in my mind. Were they really a threat or not? And I don't think the conclusion is ever really drawn out in the end. He proves, according to the statements of the church leaders, that single males were viewed as threats to society. But as I say, the question isn't really answered, were they threats to society? I don't think they were. I think Mormon single men are so frustrated simply trying to stay active in the church, they don't have time to be threats to society, especially if they're trying to stay active. He shows the struggles that they faced trying to remain active in the church. And I think especially the diary entries concerning the temple experience and the way they were treated are very poignant. And the sad thing is you find those same comments can be made today. Not the temple one. I don't think any single is kept out of the temple today from being single. But the feelings that single males have being members in the church are that poignant as well, many of them. One very important issue is not dealt with, and that needs to be done in a study of any papers on the single male. That's trying to determine, and I don't know that it's possible, at what age a single male is considered a threat. Jeff's study deals with age 20 and age 30, and then, of course, it goes on into old age and how many never marry ultimately. President Benson's conference talk in April 88 indicates that married singles that have never married are a threat after age 27. Like I say, I don't know that we can define at any one particular age, but that aspect needs to be worked on to make the paper, I think, a little stronger. It's interesting to note that most of these people, these men, did marry before death. It's a very small percentage that never marry. The other interesting aspect is that all is forgiven once these men marry. They may have been threats their entire life, but the minute they marry, they are no longer a threat, and all is forgiven of previous singlehood. The slate's wiped clean, so to speak, just the moment that vows are taken. You know, when you're viewed as a sinner for 40 years, and then all of a sudden, just by one simple act of marriage, you can erase that whole thing, I think it raises a large question as to how we view the singles even today. Another point. In comparing the Mormon and the non-Mormon villages in the paper, he compares statistics from the census, but not religious implications. And I think this is a weakness of the argument. And I don't know, it would require a lot of research going back to these villages and trying to do this. Mormons, all through the paper, are evaluated through influences of theology and religious tradition, while the non-Mormons are not. Was church influence as strong in the non-Mormon communities or towns, or was religion even an issue for the single males in those communities? And I think that needs to be determined to strengthen the paper. I would also find it very helpful when you publish it that if you put some graphs in. Simply showing the four towns and the aspects you talk about would make it much easier to visualize it. He raises the question, did poor Mormon rural singles not marry because wealthy polygamists were competing for the same young women? And at the end of the paper, he says no, but he doesn't deal with it through the paper. There's no information of showing why he comes to that conclusion, and that would strengthen it. It's a logical argument that needs to be carried out. In the paper, he compares four Mormon rural towns, one settlement in Illinois, one settlement in Iowa, which were non-Mormon in nature, Ophir, a mining town in Utah, and the 16th Ward area in Salt Lake City, which was urban. This makes for some interesting statistics, but it does make it rather awkward to see all the parallels, and that's one reason I think the graphs would help. If the Mormon, non-Mormon parallels are drawn, you need parallel studies in the non-Mormon communities. And most of the information from the non-Mormon communities tends to be generalized in nature. In the Ophir figures, the high percentage of single males in that particular community, which was a mining community, I think the conclusion can certainly be drawn that certain jobs in certain locations attract single men. Probably the same today. If you looked at the mining communities today, you would probably find a higher percentage of single males in that area than other places. Divorce is mentioned, but actual figures not given. And I think this would be helpful to understand. Was divorce common? Obviously, from the figures he has, it wasn't common at the time. It's much more of a rarity and not mentioned. But it certainly is an issue in contemporary single life. I think current figures estimate that at least one-third of the males of the church will be divorced during their lifetime. And so it's an assumption that females as well. But this does need to be broached. Church membership is documented in these figures, but not church activity, with the exception of one town. He does go into one town on church activity. This needs to be clarified, I think, again, to make your argument stronger. Now, those are nitpicky things, but I think it's such a fine paper. I really would like to see it tightened up with those. Some conclusions that I drew from the paper. I think in many instances, loneliness was greater at the turn of the century for single males than it is now, for several reasons. One, his study deals with rural areas, the distances between people, the small number of people in the community, and so on, made it much easier, I think, to be lonely than it is for single people today. Many single people are lonely today. I don't mean to imply they're not. It's just that we have far more people around and we have far more opportunities not to be lonely, so that it's easier to have a better life in that regard. Another conclusion, probably single males had a higher profile in their communities at the turn of the century than they do now, simply, again, because of sheer numbers of population and the fact of the high divorce rate. In the church community today, there are a large number of single males. The paper doesn't deal with it that much but it's also true that the divorced males are the highest rate of inactivity in the church. and so today. And so the church needs to be aware of this factor. But I'm certain the profile was higher than of being single. Another conclusion, or question really, did travel and work restrict people from meeting more possible mates than they do now? At that point in time, people did not travel like we do today. They tended to stay in the same community where everyone knew everything about one another. Today we are a very mobile society, and frequently by being mobile we can change our circumstances. We certainly allow ourselves to meet far more people than they did then. Does the fact that there are so many, or you could raise this question, or does the fact that there are so many people today in high numbers simply frustrate choice making? And do many people stay single because they can't make a choice from too many? That's one of those issues I don't know if there's an answer for. Another conclusion, commitment was obviously different then than now. You can see that in the divorce figures. And so the issue of commitment in the church is one that perhaps hasn't been studied sufficiently. Has the commitment of individuals to the concept of marriage changed, or is it the world that has changed in setting up the standards for the high divorce rate today as compared to that period of time? And were the people that were married happy, or were there a lot of very unhappy people who simply stayed married at that period of time because divorce was not considered an option? Another issue I think that needs to be considered is being in a position to provide for a wife. I think this is a legitimate question, especially at the turn of the century. With the liberation of women, so to speak, today, it's considerably different. But at that point in time, it was still very strongly viewed that the man was to provide. And if a man was not in a position to provide, then frequently he did not marry. It's mentioned in Jeff's paper that several of these people were listed as servants working for others. In Europe, it was frequently common for people who were servants to never marry because they didn't feel like they were in a position to provide. And you can raise that issue today. Are there still males in the church who perhaps have some of this Victorian feeling of providing for a wife in a certain manner that keep them from marrying? It may not be one. Another conclusion, the agony over a lack of sexual release and so on, the Victorian view of masturbation. That has certainly changed, I think, somewhat in today's society. While the church still professes this is wrong, it's frequently treated, I think, in bishops' interviews much the same as birth control. While the church may profess that this certain thing should not be practiced, eyes are certainly closed more easily when those questions are asked. But at the turn of the century, I'm certain it was much more painful. It's rather interesting, another conclusion, that while the single male in his paper was attempted to be turned away at the temple and had to stand up for his own rights to enter the temple, certainly that's not the case today, but you still find that Brigham Young University will not hire single males. And so you still find elements of this kind of situation existing. Another conclusion, are single males still on the fringes of the church? I'm afraid so in most instances. Single males are second-class citizens, or certainly it's very easy to feel as a second-class citizen in the church today. It takes a strong personality to be willing to overlook a lot of the insensitiveness that does exist and to proceed in a regular manner as a member of the church. Another conclusion, he mentions ultimately that about 1.5% of the males in his study never married, ever. That's really a very small percentage. Far too small of a percentage, I think, for the church to ever feel that they were really a threat to society and to the church. Today, in current figures, it's estimated that about 3% of the males never marry. So in effect, that is a 50% increase, but it's still a very small figure in the church. the amount of guilt, too, that I think is thrust upon the single member of the church because of the doctrines he mentions, is another thing that we need to be very sensitive to. People have a lot of guilt in this life anyway, and no one's perfect, and so as long as we're not perfect, it's easy to have guilt. But when you have the guilt of not only committing a sin because you are not fulfilling your covenant, but you are keeping other people from fulfilling their covenants because it's still viewed that the male does the asking for marriage, that's a huge amount of guilt to put on any male. And it's one of the reasons that so many become inactive in the church if they are not married and or if they're divorced. One last conclusion. Basically, you can tell in the writings, and especially the journal entries, men are not sensitive to men at that point of time. Well, I think I can still say men are not sensitive to men. Men are notoriously hard on men. We're taught in the priesthood quorums and so on that motherhood, women are sacrosanct, they're to be honored, and generally speaking, in most divorce situations, if you generalize, you find that the male is, in most instances, one of the ones that causes the divorce for many reasons. And so men are very, very hard on other men. And this makes this very strong problem the church needs to deal with in its priesthood quorums in order to keep people active. I think the church needs to evaluate all of its manuals and its programs very carefully. There are no lessons in priesthood manuals on dealing with singleness among males. And it's not that they have to advocate it at all, but they do need to be sensitive to it. Men do not touch. Men do not fellowship one another the same way women do. If you walk into a Relief Society room, you will see women put their arm around another woman, even kiss or hug her. If a man did that, automatically you know what would happen. Well, I'm not saying that a man has to do that, but there is something to physical touch in fellowshipping. Simply putting your arm around a fellow and saying, "Welcome to the quorum." Things of this nature. There are things that can be done to sensitize people to help all the single men of the church stay into the church, single men stay in the church and stay active. Well, like I say, most of those comments are rather nitpicky. It's a fine paper. I hope that it's published soon, and I hope it's something that many people read. I think it will help sensitize many people to the needs of the single males of the church.
We have about 10 minutes left. We have enough time for maybe one or two questions. Sir, if you have any questions, would you please come to the microphone for sake of the audio tape?
Could you just fill out the perspective of how many single women were there at the same time? Nowadays, how many single men are there?
When Levina Fielding Anderson did a study on single women, in the 19th century, she had a hard time finding single women because of the issues of plural marriage made it so that it was very difficult. There are a few, and maybe the same amount, but it was difficult for her to find single women. Then, after plural marriage, then it's quite easily to find it. Jesse?
How did you select those non-marriage
women?
What stood out?
Why? Well, the question was, how did I select the two non-Mormon communities? I selected, I wanted one that was a stable, that had been going a long time, and I wanted a developing one. And I just thought the Midwest was comparable to Utah, and so I just found them. And actually, both of them had nice history, so I could know a little bit about them, published histories. Well, that is a very important question that I would like to investigate. I don't know. Did everybody hear that question? He's asking about how do I know, I'm talking about there's such a few single men in the communities, how did I know that men didn't leave? Well, I think I do know that they'd left, and I think Ophir is a real good example. Ophir was a mining town here in the middle of Utah, had a high percentage of single men, and I think a lot of these single men came from these rural communities. I just don't, I'm trying to figure out how to test all that, and I haven't been able to figure out. Some of these communities are small enough, I guess I could study each family and see if they had sons that left and where they went to. But it's just really time consuming.
Jeff, would prayer dogs also perpetuate singleness?
Probably, because it isolated them from, it put them into a male society and isolated them from women. Probably what happened was that very thing, especially in these Utah towns, that men did go there and work and get enough money to go back and get married. Others maybe got caught into to not ever being able to make the money. Yes? It's obviously we're higher than being an agricultural laborer or a servant in the household. It's really hard to know. In the 19th century, there was this strong feeling that you weren't very successful unless you owned land. And even though these miners made good money, they didn't own land. So there was that pressure to be own land. Yes. I have some comments on that. I appreciate your... one of the things is that I was studying, tended to study single men in this just 20-year period. I want to study more aspects of singleness. I don't know how, and I've actually it's impossible to find out, about homosexuality. One of my things, though, that maybe was subtle in the paper, people assume today that all single men... men that are single are homosexual. And I don't think that's true. And in fact, quite a few of the homosexuals I know are married. One of the things that you notice from De Saul's diary is that his sexual tensions, he was interested in women. Just because he was single doesn't mean he was homosexual. So I've been trying in my studies to separate those two things. Obviously, though, it is an issue in studying single men. But several of the single Mormon men that I study are obviously heterosexual. Others, I don't know how to find out those that were homosexual.
It depends on... this hasn't always been their policy. And so some were hired, and there's still some single males working down there today. But they were hired at a time before any unwritten policy went into effect.
When did that go into effect?
I couldn't give you the exact year, but I know they haven't hired single men for, I think, at least the last 10 years. Do you want me to answer? We both will. I don't think so. I think the tradition is that men have been sort of the focus of history through the tradition of time. And so with the focusing on women's issues and women, it certainly brought them more to the forefront. But singleness itself has never been dealt with all that much. And so I think now we're just sort of starting into the realm of singleness, but I don't think we're picked on because the women have been.
I wanted to make a comment about the church's dealing. It seems a lot easier for the church to deal with single women. Several years ago, I was involved in giving input into the general boards. And one of the questions I ask is, it seems like there's a lot of single women on the general boards, and there are no single men. And I was told that there are no single men that are worthy enough to be on a general board. So that tells you, that these single women are not suspect of anything. They're just, I guess they're assumed... but the single men are. The other thing, too, is that the Relief Society has dealt with this and in their lessons and in their manuals and stuff. But there's...
men ought to be able to cope, but women need help.
Yes.
Women are seen as victims and men are sinners,
so
perpetrators.
We have to kind of nurture the women along, but the single men...
the Mormon communities... under over 20, 18% were single in 1880, and 19% in 1900. Over 33% in both areas. So those are the four Mormon communities. In the non-Mormon Midwest communities, almost a third of the men over 20 were single. In Illinois, 15%. In 1880 and 19% in 1900 were over 30 were single. So they were comparing 3% with 15 and 19%.
Can I just add one comment to Fran's question? On the single men on general boards and this thing that we were talking about, one thing that is different is single women are placed on those positions as role models. Obviously, single men cannot be role models. And so you find that distinction has to be made.
I can't go without mentioning Orrin Hatch's statement about the appointee the candidate for the Supreme Court. I thought it was interesting that he would mention on national TV that perhaps the candidate to the Supreme Court is not a good candidate because he's single, has never married. I thought this was interesting coming from a Mormon senator.
I'm sorry, we're several minutes over time and we don't have any time for any more questions, but I want to thank Jeffrey Johnson and Delmon Oswald for their speech and their comments. Thank you for coming. Thanks.
Wish you had more journals.